A lot of stuff to cover, and we only have two lectures left. So I'm trying to tell you as much as I can, but I don't want to overwhelm you at the same time. So if at any point it looks like I'm going way too fast, just tell me. Okay, so the first thing we need to talk about is the elephant in the room. Is the conformal algebra in 2D really infinite dimensional? Because that's what everyone keeps saying. Then we're going to talk about the primary operators and quasi-primary operators. I'm going to explain what those are in two dimensions with our formalism of the complex coordinates. We're going to look at the energy momentum tensor. We're going to talk about radial ordering and the operator product expansion in 2D. And ideally, if we actually manage to do it, we're going to talk about the Virasoro algebra. Okay, so let's start with the first question. Why is this question important, and why are we even asking this question? Well, we saw last time that the conformal group for R2 is essentially a SL2C mod Z2. And this is a finite dimensional group, which has dimension 6. So if this group is finite dimensional, then the Lie algebra is also finite dimensional. And we saw that was the one generated by L naught, L plus minus 1, and the complex conjugates. These were the generators of the actual conformal transformations, the one that you can invert. But then we have the Witt algebra that has Ln and L bar n. Now, n can be anything in Z. So this one is infinite dimensional. This one is finite dimensional. Which one should we use and why? Well, the whole idea of two-dimensional conformal field theory is that because we have a lot more generators of conformal transformations, we can impose more constraints, and then we can actually solve things. That's why we like two dimensions. But what is the justification for using this algebra instead of this algebra? There's a few justifications, and they may convince you or not. I'm going to give you three of them in order of how much they convince me. The first one is that we only care about the infinitesimal transformations. I think this is the weakest excuse. The idea is, well, in physics, we don't really care about global transformation. So who cares about the group? We care about the Lie algebra, which is fine, but the Lie algebra of the conformal group is still finite dimensional. If we exponentiate the things in here, you're going to get things that are not invertible anyway. So they are not really symmetries. So this one, well, it may convince you. It doesn't convince me very much. The second one is that it works as most things that we do in physics, even if they're not mathematically entirely rigorous or make sense, as long as they work, we're happy with it. So this is a bit more convincing because if we can use this thing and actually get results that make sense, then we're happy. Is anyone convinced at this point? That's okay. You shouldn't be. Now, what convinces me is the next one. So the problem is that we are in Euclidean spacetime. So really, we should be in R11, which is the two-dimensional Minkowski space. So what we're doing is, as usual, instead of working with Minkowski space, we do a weak rotation, and we bring it to Euclidean space. So usually this works. In this case, this breaks things because the conformal group of R11 is actually infinite dimensional. So if instead of doing a weak rotation and then figure out what the conformal transformations are, you first do figuring out the conformal transformations, and then after you weak rotate, that's how you get this infinite dimensional algebra. Because you should have an infinite dimensional algebra to start with, then when you do a weak rotation, you're going to take a different section of this algebra. If you think of this as a complex the algebra with these generators and these generators completely distinct, then how you decide which ones are the real ones and which ones are not depends on how you take a section of it. We saw that in the Euclidean case, you just take essentially ln plus L bar n or ln minus L bar n, and then you divide by I. So you essentially take the real and imaginary part. It's a bit different if you use Lorentz metric, but that's the idea. So we just took the weak rotation too early. Does this convince you a bit more? And then you may ask, well, why don't we just work in Lorentzian space-time and just keep going with that? Well, you can, but you should know by now this is way more complicated. Not to mention that you don't get any of those nice holomorphic functions. And one of the great things about two dimensions for CFTs is that once you get everything is holomorphic, you can actually use complex analysis to help you in a lot of things. So we're going to see that quite a bit today. So hopefully this convinces you that we're not doing something completely crazy, but there's a reason behind using the full conformal algebra instead of just the restricted one, which is the Lie algebra of the conformal group. Any questions at this point? Okay, so that answers the first question. And now we can start talking about what the primary operators are in our CFT. So primary operators essentially behave the same as in normal CFTs. It's just that this time we have more transformations, so we have to add a bit more constraint. And in addition to that, we're using a new formalism, which is the complex coordinates. So the idea is this. So we have phi that depends on z, z bar, is some field that has a scaling dimension delta. And because we are in two dimensions, we can actually put together both the scaling dimension and the spin. So we can actually talk about things with spin without any problems. So we have a scaling dimension delta and the planar spin S. It's planar spin because you have only one possible rotation. There's one generator of rotations. And so we only have the one spin number that describes everything. Okay, so at this point, we need to figure out what happens when we transform our coordinates with the conformal transformations. We need to figure out what happens to phi. So if we have z prime equals lambda z, where lambda is just some positive real number. So we're rescaling things. What do you expect to happen to phi? So what is phi prime at lambda z bar? What do we expect?
Lambda to the minus delta.
Okay, so we get lambda to the minus delta. And then?
Phi squared, so it's a bar.
Yeah, so just phi at the previous point. So far this makes sense. It's very reasonable. It's exactly what we've seen in any dimension. It doesn't really matter that we're using complex coordinates or not. Now, if we take z to e to the I theta z, we're doing a rotation. Because this is just a way to encode rotations in the complex plane. It's the same as doing the matrix cosine theta minus sine theta, cosine theta, just a lot more compact. So now, what do we expect to happen here? This should be e to the I theta. And this is e to the minus I theta because we're taking the complex conjugate. What do you think we're going to get here?
So we now need to take care of the spin, right?
Yes. So now we have to use the spin.
Should be some generators of the spin as representation of phi.
Yeah, so if we were doing this normally, we will need some matrix that describes a rotation. So this is some representation of e to the I theta. Now, lucky for us, in two dimensions, the group SO2 is one dimensional. Which means in particular, it means that it's abelian. And the fact that it's abelian means that the representations are all one-dimensional. So this means that this is not actually a matrix. It's just going to be a complex number. And as it turns out, the representations are just e to the I theta, but you multiply it by the spin. So it's going to be just e to the I s theta phi z, z bar. And we must have s, which is an alpha integer. And we're allowing for spin. If we just take s to representations, you will get integer ones. But because we have projected representations, because of quantum mechanics, then you also allow spin. So it can be 0, 1 half, 1, and so on. So this is how we expect these two things to operate. And at this point, it will be really useful to try to put them together. So the third thing we want to do is z prime equals lambda e to the I theta z. So essentially, we're rescaling z by any complex number. It doesn't have to be real. It doesn't have to be on the unit circle. So at this point, we can just use what we had so far. So I'm just going to call this thing alpha, so I don't have to write it all the time. So we have phi prime at alpha z, alpha bar, z bar. It just should be the combination of these two things. So we expect this to be lambda to the minus delta e to the I s theta phi z, z bar. Now, because we don't want to have lambda and e to the I theta separated anymore, we want to write this in terms of alpha only. We're just going to guess that this looks like alpha to the minus h for some h, and alpha bar to the minus h bar for some h bar, phi z, z bar. So at this point, it's just a guess. If you want to be more fancy, it's an ansatz. We're guessing this thing. We're going to prove that it actually works. Now, this is a very important point here. So I'm going to write that in red. H bar is not the complex conjugate of H. This is very important. It gets the three exclamation marks treatment. Now, why am I putting a bar on top of it instead of calling it something else? Because everyone else does it, and if I call this something other than h, it's fine here, but then you're going to see h bar everywhere and you're going to get confused. So it's better that I tell you that we call it h bar, but it's not a complex conjugate, rather than not telling you anything and then create problems for you later.
It's not a complex conjugate because you have to divide by 2 pi, right?
It's not a complex conjugate because we're going to see in a moment that it's actually a real number. Okay, so at this point, we just need to equate this with this. So if you rewrite again lambda e to the I theta to the h, then we have lambda e to the minus I theta, or to the minus h minus h bar, we're going to get lambda to the minus h minus h bar, and e to the I theta to the minus h plus h bar. Now, this should be the same as lambda to the minus delta e to the I s theta. So this means that h is going to be 1 half delta minus s, and h bar is going to be 1 half delta plus s. So as you can see, because scaling dimension and s are both real numbers, these are both real quantities. There is no complex anything in here. So if you thought of this as a complex conjugate, you would actually get the same as h, and then it would be not getting the right result. Now we're going to call the pair h and h bar the conformal dimension. So it's just a way to encode together in the same quantity both the spin and the scaling dimension. And this is something that we can only do in two dimensions. So because of our properties, everything can be just put together in one quantity, which is kind of symmetric. Okay, so at this point, we just need to generalize. Just the way we do this for normal conformal transformations, we're going to say that phi is primary, if when z prime equals f of z, and f is just some holomorphic transformation, it doesn't matter what it is, it doesn't have to be invertible, then we're going to have phi prime f of z, f bar of z bar. It's just going to be the derivative of f with respect to z to the minus h, df over d bar minus h bar, phi of z, z bar. So this is the definition in general. You can see that it fits with everything we've done here. If you actually let f of z equal zero scaling, you're going to get exactly the same thing. And more generally, you expect to get this. So this is essentially our generalization of the idea that in general, you get the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian to the scaling dimension. But we are doing this more generally to allow spin. If you set your operators to be scalar, you just set s equals 0, this actually ends up being the determinant of the Jacobian. So you get exactly the same formula as before. But this time you also allow for spin, so this is more general. And that's something we can do in two dimensions. Now, finally, we say f is quasi-primary if this works only for f in a cell 2C over Z2. So essentially, if this only works for the global transformations, the ones that are actually invertible, you still have something nice, but you call it a quasi-primary operator and not primary. If it actually transforms this way under any possible holomorphic transformation, that is any conformal transformation, actually we also need with df over dz different than zero. So in addition to being holomorphic, it must be locally invertible, otherwise you're going to have trouble here when you try to divide this thing by something. But other than that, any holomorphic function, if this satisfies that, you call it primary, otherwise quasi-primary. And finally, if it's not primary or quasi-primary, we say phi is secondary. So there are three options. Either phi satisfies this for any possible conformal transformation, even non-invertible, then it's primary. If it's only for the invertible ones, then it's quasi-primary. If neither of them work, then you just call it secondary and just leave it be. Any questions?
So the discussion that we did there was for was only valid for primary for
okay, so this discussion here, this is valid for anything that is scaling invariant. So this is less than quasi-primary. If you only have this, you are not quasi-primary, it will still be a secondary operator. But this is the idea that you should have something that rescales nicely. So you can have theories that are not conformal invariant, but as long as they're scalar invariant, they're scaling invariant, then this you expect it to work. And it's the idea that because phi is some dimension, when you rescale dimensions, you should rescale phi as well. You cannot just stay with it is because it's not just a pure number, it has dimension associated to it. And that's where this comes from. And rotations, we expect our things to always be Poincaré invariant anyway. At the very least, it should be Poincaré invariant, which means it must be rotation invariant. So this part should work as well. So this we expect to happen for all possible fields.
But we have secondary operators that do not have that, right? No, because it's only, okay, got it, sorry.
Yes. So this we expect to happen all the time. If this doesn't happen, then we're in trouble. But this only happens for things that are conformal invariant. Yes?
If I'm able to write like the f of c or partial f of c, something like this, as a lambda of c, e to the I theta of c, isn't there an analog for this like intermediary formula that we had there of the lambda to the minus delta e to the I s theta?
So this formula here?
Yeah.
Yes, it's just that we don't expect that to work in general. This is a very simple, it's just a rescaling. We're not even shifting anything. So it's a very simple conformal transformation.
But if I write, like, for example, partial f partial z as being a lambda of z e to the I theta of z, is that still not valid? Or?
Well, then we don't have a representation here that works the same anymore. The representation is going to depend on the point. So you're going to have things that are unclear. I mean, you expect it to work like this eventually. But the point is, if you are Poincaré invariant, you're only invariant if you have a global rotation. If you start having rotations that are different at every point, then you have a conformal transformation. You're going to have something that's likely to be a special conformal transformation. And you're only going to transform the way if you're a primary operator. So you can do that, and that's probably a way to justify why you would get the f over the z, which we're not really proving. I'm mostly telling you this. That part there was to justify why this makes sense. We don't have time to go and actually prove this thing. But hopefully it makes at least enough sense to you. Any other questions about this? OK, so at this point, we have covered the first two parts. Now we have to talk about the energy momentum tensor. Now, hopefully you did the parts from last tutorial about this, so you already know what I'm about to tell you, and I don't have to convince you. But if we have the energy momentum tensor and we're in a CFT, we know that we should have T mu mu equals zero. We should have a traceless energy momentum tensor. And it turns out that this means, in terms of our new coordinates, that we should have T z z bar equals T z bar z equals zero. And moreover, T z bar z bar is the same as the complex conjugate of T z z. And you can just check this by doing the actual transformations from Euclidean coordinates to complex coordinates. And then the fact that T mu nu is conserved tells you that the derivative respect to z of T, I think this one is tz bar. Yes, so tz bar z bar equals dz bar tzz equals zero. And now this is important because it's telling you that this is holomorphic. Because it does not depend on z bar. Or if you want, these are the Cauchy-Riemann equations for this function of z. And so we're going to redefine things, and we're going to introduce t that now depends only on z, because this is the holomorphic one. This is just going to be the same as t zz. And then we're going to have t bar of z bar, which is t z bar, which happens to be the complex conjugate of the one above. So these are the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic components.
What is the
yes?
Isn't t z bar equal to t z z?
Yeah, because if that's true, then zero.
This, yeah, sorry, there should be a bar on top of something. I forgot the bar. Yes. So this is the complex conjugate of this. You can just pull the complex conjugate from the z to the top of the t, which is why these two things are complex conjugate to each other. OK, so hopefully this is clear. You should have seen all these calculations already, which is why I'm not telling them. Now, this is extremely useful, because then we're going to be able to integrate over these things. And because it's holomorphic, we can do lots of nice things, which is the whole reason why we're using this formalism. Okay, am I going good enough for pace? Is it too fast? Okay, so now that we know this, and actually let me tell you something else, just so that you know the names that people use. Sometimes we call the holomorphic components, we call them chiral. And the anti-holomorphic, we call them anti-chiral. Just so if you see them, you know what they mean. And in general, whenever you have a field that depends only on z, you call it chiral. If it depends only on z bar, you call it antichiral. Yes?
Are they correlated? Like, it's physically related to chirality, I guess?
Yes. I'm not completely sure how it connects to that at this point. It's just the way people call them. I usually just call them holomorphic and anti-holomorphic because that's what they are. I'm just telling you that's what people call them. Sometimes they just call them left and right. And then you have to decide which one is left and which one is right. So we're just going to call them holomorphic and anti-holomorphic so that no one is confused. Okay, so at this point, we need to talk about ordering, but actually let me do that in a bit. It's probably best if I do this in a different order. Okay, so at this point, what we want to do is try to figure out if you have A of Z, which is some, A of Z, Z bar, is some operator. We want to find out what happens to the operator after we change with the conformal transformation. So essentially, we want to know what if x goes to, well, sorry, z goes to z plus epsilon psi of z. So we have an infinitesimal conformal transformation. And we're allowing this to be any conformal transformation. It doesn't have to be invertible. Then what is delta of A? And the idea is that, yes, for primary operators, we know what this is supposed to be. But in general, what are we going to get here? And what we're going to get is that we know already that the transformation of the operators is going to be induced by the charge associated to this transformation. So we're going to have a current associated to the transformation, which is just going to be something like this. It's just going to be essentially we get the T mu psi nu. This is just the idea in Euclidean coordinates. And if we take the charge Q to just be the integral, because you have only one coordinate, we're going to think of x as the time. We take the integral with respect to y, which is the other coordinate of j0. We expect this to give us this. I'm going to call this q psi so that we know it's the charge associated to this transformation. And we get the commutator with A. So hopefully this is something you're familiar with, but the idea is that the charges at the quantum level, the charge associated to a certain transformation, is going to be the generator of the transformations for the operators. So this is what we expect to get. And at this point is where we want to use our formalism, because this integral is going to become something very nice if we use complex coordinates. So the idea at this point is, if we have z goes to z plus epsilon psi z, like I wrote before, then the charge associated to this is going to be, we have an integral like this, and this integral is now going to become an integral for complex variables. So we're going to get, we need to put the factor 2 pi I in front so that things work nicely because we're working with complex integrals. And we're just going to have dz psi of z dz. And then we're going to have the same thing for the anti-holomorphic part. So this is essentially what we get by translating this thing into our complex formalism, which means that if we want to do the change in some operator A, all we need to do is to take the commutator with this and A itself. And this commutator is just going to be we're going to get the minus in front, 1 over 2 pi I, then we have this integral, dz, we have epsilon z, and we have, in some sense, the commutator of tz and a, which we need to take at a different point. So let me just put it at point w plus the anti-holomorphic terms. I'm going to be skipping these anti-holomorphic terms all the time. Can you see at this point here? So whenever I write plus anti-holomorphic, it means it's essentially the same thing, but you're putting bars over everything. Okay, so this is the idea, and I cannot go in too many details about these things because we don't have time, but if you have any questions, of course. Yes?
We used to have like an open integral, right? Over like the space-like surface, let's put it this way.
Yes.
How did it turn into a complex, closed contour integral?
That's a very good question, and I'm going to answer this together with something else in a moment. So don't worry, I'll actually give you a good reason for why, but that's a great question. Why are we doing an integral over something which is closed now instead of integrating over the whole real line?
And what's the region where we're integrating? I mean, it's a closed region, but which region is it?
That's, again, another great question, because at this point we have to decide, what does this really mean? And the problem is that if this was just something that had to do with numbers, if t was a number and not an operator, then this would make sense. You just integrate over numbers and everything is fine. But because t is an operator and things don't commute, then we need to figure out what does this mean? What does integrating over this commutator mean? And we're going to answer this question, the question about the region where we're integrating and the question about why is it a closed thing, all in one shot, which is great. And that's what we're going to do now. I'm going to keep the questions here, and now we're going to be talking about this radial ordering. So the idea for this is, as I was saying, there's some ambiguities because there's operators. We need to decide how to put them in a certain order. Normally, what we do is just take time ordering. So we need to find some way to time order these things. So now what we're going to do is, instead of actually working with Euclidean space, we're going to work with something which is not actually the same. And what we're going to do is, we're going to work with a cylinder. So now our coordinates, x, y, are going to be such that x, y gives you the same point as x, y plus 2 pi. So y is going to be a coordinate. If you have our cylinder, x is the coordinate that tells us where we are on the cylinder, and y is the coordinate that tells us on the surface of the cylinder where we are. So y is now compactified because it only goes from 0 to 2 pi, and then it goes back to itself. And this should answer the question you had about why is that integral now a closed thing? Because if you integrate over y, but y actually goes from 0 to 2 pi, you're integrating on a closed curve. So the idea is that instead of having the whole plane, we are instead doing this. But then you may wonder, well, how does this relate to our complex formalism that we had so far? This seems crazy. But as it turns out, we can map this to complex coordinates. And this was also a question on the last tutorial. I hope you have seen it, especially since the answer was actually there because I forgot it. So the idea is that you use this map. So we're going to have z this time, instead of being x plus a y, is going to be e to the x plus I y. So if we do this, we're going to take this cylinder, and we're actually mapping it to the whole complex plane minus one point, which is the origin. Because the idea is that this now gives you a phase factor. This gives you a scaling factor, so you can get any possible scale by just moving up and down with x. And then once you fix that, you can just change y to give you a whole circle with that particular distance from the origin. And so you can get the whole complex plane minus zero, unless you allow x to go to minus infinity. So some things to notice here is that if x represents time, then we have, when x is minus infinity, we get z equals zero. So this means that the infinite past is mapped to zero, while x equals infinity sends z to infinity. So the infinite future is mapped to z infinity, to z equals infinity. And as I mentioned, if x is a constant, so we get a slice of this cylinder, then we get z equals e to the sum constant, e to the iy, which is a circle. So this map takes slices of the cylinder and maps them to circles in the complex plane. And because x represents time, then all of these circles, depending on how big they are, they tell us at what time we are supposed to be. Yes?
What does it mean to say that x represents time if the charges we were integrating over y? And on the other hand, also, what metric are we putting on the cylinder such that the map like carries our x, y into like the sets of bar that we were working with?
Yes, okay. So they're both great questions. So first of all, the first question, if I understand correctly, is why we think of x as time if we're integrating over y here?
Oh, no, sorry, because we want to integrate over space.
We are supposed to integrate over space, right? The charge, what we do is integrate over the spatial thing, and then this depends on time only, but then it's conserved, so it actually doesn't depend on anything. So that's why we integrate over y. And we are doing this compactification this way, because then we can do things nicely and do integrals that are only on closed surface, on closed lines. And the other question is, what metric do we put on the cylinder? We put a flat metric on the cylinder. And as it turns out, if the metric you're putting on the cylinder is flat, so you're just saying ds squared equals dx squared plus dy squared, so usual metric, when you convert to these complex coordinates, you get something that's conformally similar to the metric we've been working on. And I think there's something about it in the next tutorial anyway, so you'll be able to see it. But you get exactly the same thing up to a factor of modulus of z squared, which means that some things are different, but overall, the results are the same. It doesn't really change anything. So we are kind of sweeping that under the rug. Yes?
So essentially, we're looking at this cylindrical version of like Minkowski spacetime, but with a flat standard Riemannian metric.
And yes.
What happens is that, like, I mean, in Minkowski spacetime, at least, if you change reference frame in that cylindrical version of it, you get like non-closed time, like space, like surfaces, and all kinds of like crazy stuff. So, like, how does that work with like coordinate changes in Minkowski spacetime? Let's.
Okay, so I'll give you the intuition for why we're doing this whole thing. So the idea of this is, we use this particular picture to do all our calculations from now on, because this is what you usually do in string theory. And the reason why we're doing this whole thing about 2D conformal field theories is at least half of it is because of string theory. And the idea of it is if you have a closed string, which is something like this, and you make it evolve in time, as it evolves, it's going to have a word sheet instead of a word line because it's a two-dimensional object, and it's going to be essentially a cylinder, or at least you can deform it back into a cylinder. So what happens in string theory is that if you then make things Euclidean by doing a big rotation, this is the picture you get. So this will be the metric that you get after doing the big rotation. And then we go to complex coordinates, and then we start doing all these things. So that's the idea that we have. So this happens already after the big rotation. Is that clear enough?
Yeah. Yeah, it just looks like we're privileging a coordinate system or an observer for that.
It is Euclidean,
right? But there is time. I mean, when you make the Euclidean shift, it's like,
when you go back to five on spatial dimension, you are privileging the reference frame, which sees the complexification at second to second.
Okay.
Why is that a problem?
Well,
sure.
You sounded super Matos.
We actually learned that from Matos.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can talk about this later because we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, sure.
So let's assume that everything works for now. Okay, so coming back now to this, now that we have this radial thing, we can interpret, if we interpret x to be time, and we're mapping these things to circles, now we can actually have an interpretation of what it means to be ordered in time. Now, before we do that, I wanted to actually show you what this transformation looks like. So this map that we had, the one that maps the string to the plane, that's essentially this. This is our cylinder. I just took it to be of finite height, but you can extend it. And what we're doing is we're taking this cylinder and essentially doing this. We are taking the value slices, we are enlarging them so that they become the exponential of themselves in radius, and then we flatten the whole thing so that we map everything to the plane. So this is what's really happening. And this is the image that we get of that cylinder under our map. And as you make the height higher and higher, you're going to end up getting the whole complex plane, and you make the things that are with x very, well, negative and big in absolute value, they're going to get closer and closer to the origin, but never actually reach it. So this is what's happening. And if you look again at what's happening here, things that are at higher times, so say this one here, respect to this one, is going to end up in a circle of bigger radius. So all of these circles here, they are essentially the circles of equals time. At each equal time, you're going to get a different circle. As time increases, you get bigger and bigger circles. And that's what we're going to use to order things. Essentially, when we want to find out whether z or w come before or after in time, we look at the radius of the circle, which means we look at their absolute value. Everything clear about this picture? OK, so back to what we had to do. At this point, we can introduce an actual ordering.
Okay,
Okay, so now if you have two operators, A and B, at two different points in the complex plane. Now, in theory, they may also depend on Z bar and W bar. I'm just going to skip that so it's a little bit more compact, but it doesn't affect anything. We're going to define these to be. So we want to time order these things. So we want to put the things that have smaller time on the right, because they're going to act first on things. And then the things that come at later times, we want to put them on the left. So time depends on whether the absolute value of Z is greater than W or not. So what do you expect we're going to use as ordering if absolute value of Z is greater than absolute value of W? Which one comes first, A or B?
B.
So you want to put B here and then A? Okay, so the reason why this is ambiguous is that we read things one way, the way we normally read, but if these things are acting on a state, the one that acts first is going to be the one on the right. So we want the one on the right to be the one that comes first in time. So if Z is greater than W, then the time of Z is greater than the time of W. So this means that W should be on the right. So that's going to be our ordering, and we're just going to swap them. If this time Z comes before W. So this is just our way to define ordering of operators in such a way that it makes sense. Yes?
Shouldn't we pick up a sign if we are acting on fermions?
Yes, that's a great addition. In theory, you should also possibly adding a minus sign here if you're dealing with fermions. So that formula from before assumes everything is bosonic. If you're adding fermions, you should also take into account this.
But
yes?
What if they're the same?
What if they're the same, same time? Then we don't really know what happens.
Okay.
But this is the way we usually do things in quantum field theory. We always have times that are distinct. If they are at the same time, then we start having problems because we don't know how to order things. So we're always going to assume that we have these situations. What happens is that we do have to deal with cases where they are the same, but we just first two things assuming they're different, then we take the limit from Z that goes to W, and then ideally things work. Okay, so why do we do this? Well, because now we can make sense of this integral. We can make sense of what it means to integrate this commutator. So now when you have the integral over dz, and then we have commutator of az bw, we need to figure out how to integrate this thing. So what we're going to do is write it as the integral of az bw minus the integral of bw az. But these integrals, we're going to do them on different circles. So this should just be on some circles around W. But what we're going to do here is, I'm going to write these things and then I'm going to do a picture so it's clear what's happening. So I'm going to write here, this one we want W to go first, so this should be W greater than Z. Yes. That's it. So what I really mean here is this. So suppose this is the origin, and this is our point W. And here we have the circular radius. Norm of W. Now we're going to do these two integrals. We're going to do one of them. We're going to integrate on a circle which is a bit bigger. Then W. So specifically this one. Because we want all the z's that are in some circle which satisfies this, we want to take something kind of like this. So it's a bit outside of this thing and it encircles W this way. And it's going to go counterclockwise. All of these things go counterclockwise by convention. So this is the circle that we're going to use here. For this one, we want z to be smaller than W in radius. So we're going to take something inside here instead. So we take something like this. And we also take the limit. We didn't really write it, but there's a limit for the radius of. Well, let's do it this way. Let's do z is the radius of W plus some epsilon. This should be minus epsilon. This is otherwise the limit doesn't make sense. And then we just do the limit as epsilon goes to 0 from the right because you want it to be positive. So what we're doing is we first integrate over a circle that's a little bit bigger than this radius so that things make sense. So this is ordered the way we want it. We do the same here, ordered the way we want it, and then we take the limit as epsilon goes to 0, which is essentially going to give us the difference of this path and this path when they actually match. So the difference is going to end up being just this circle around W. So eventually, this becomes the integral over just some circle around W of the radial ordered product of AZ and BW. So this is how we're going to actually do these integrals when we have operators in them. If we had to do the integral of this commutator, what we do is really the integral of the radial order product of them. So that's the big idea here. And at this point, we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to get to at least to the operator product expansion. So we're actually going to do one of these integrals. So I'll keep this here. Okay, so we're going to need the formula. And what we want to do now is, if phi is primary, we want to find out what delta phi is. And we can do this in two ways. We can either do that integral, or we can just use the fact that I think I just erased that phi prime of fz f bar z bar is df over dz dh df bar over dz bar minus h bar phi of z bar. Now this means that if you write f of z as z plus epsilon psi, which is a function of z, if you expand this thing and you try to find the variation of phi, you're just going to find that this equals. And you can do this yourself because you don't have time, but hopefully you believe me. We get minus h. So for this, we get the minus h coming from this part. Then we're going to get the derivative with respect to z of psi, which multiplies phi. Then we're going to get the same thing with the bars on top. So minus h bar, dz bar, epsilon bar, phi. And then we're going to get the derivatives of this, which give us dz phi times psi minus dz bar phi times psi bar. Okay, so this is the variation, this the infinitesimal version of this formula. For infinitesimal transformations, this is how phi changes. And at the same time, this is supposed to be the integral that we have over there. So this is going to be 1 over 2 pi I with the minus in front that we integrate over the commutator. And I just told you the commutator is really the same as integrating over the radial ordering. So that's what this thing here is telling us. So we have the radial order product of tz phi w w bar plus the anti-holomorphic part.
Sign there?
Yes, times psi. That's extremely important, otherwise nothing works anymore. So times psi. Okay, so at this point, we just need to try to mesh these two things. So now it looks like we have something that doesn't have any integrals on this side, something that has integrals on this side, and we don't know how to mesh them. And this is where complex analysis is going to help us. Now, complex analysis tells us that when we have psi, now all of these things, because we use z as the integration variable, we're going to evaluate them at something else. We're going to call it w here. So this, and actually, the nth derivative of this thing with respect to w can be written as n factorial over 2 pi I, where the integral dz epsilon over z minus w to the n plus 1. So I think this is Cauchy's integral formula, if I didn't forget any pieces of it. Yes?
Yeah, just here we only had the z and the w. So if we have z, if we have z and z bar, is the circle, we have both circles integrable?
Yeah, so you're asking what happens if I have both z and z bar? Nothing happens, you just write comma z bar, comma w bar. The circle is the same idea because in the there's this ambiguity about these coordinates. Sometimes we have to think of them as real coordinates, so they are not really distinct. They're not really the same, but if you are thinking in complex coordinates, then z and z bar describe the same things. The absolute value of z is the same as the absolute value of z bar. The circles are the same.
So we only have one circle around?
Yes, and that's because the absolute value of z is the same as absolute value of z bar. So if you think of it as z on a circle, then z bar is also on the same circle. Z bar is just reflected with respect to the y-axis. So if you're in the circle, you are at this point here, this is z, then z bar is going to be here. But since you're integrating over it, it doesn't really matter. Although it probably changes orientation. Okay, so if we use this formula, because we have here derivatives of psi and just psi itself, so this formula works both for the derivatives and just psi itself. N can be 0, and you're still going to have the integral over z minus w. So this means that if you try to mix and match all the things from here, you can rewrite this as an integral. And if you try to match all the terms, you're going to find out that you must have r of t z phi of w bar. You must have, so you're going to get a term with a z minus w to the 2 that comes from the derivative of psi. So that's this term here. So you should have an h in front of that. Then you divide by z minus w squared, and then we multiply by phi w omega bar. Then we're going to have a term that has z minus w, that's the one with n equals 0, that comes from this piece here. That's the derivative of phi, but psi is on its own. So we get just 1 over z minus w dw phi w bar. And now, because you are doing an integral in a closed curve in a complex plane, if there's any things that don't actually blow up, it doesn't matter. All we care about are the things that are singular. So we're going to have plus, we're going to write it as O1. They are all terms that are either constant or they are order 1 in z minus w or they're order 2 and so on. But those don't actually give you any trouble. So this is what we get out of this formula. And this is the operator product expansion of this product. So if we take the product of the energy momentum tensor, the holomorphic part, with phi, you're going to get these two terms plus other terms that we don't really care about. And the idea is that if you think in the operator product expansion way, if you are looking far away and you can identify these two things because they are close enough from where you're looking, then these terms don't matter because they are of order z minus w and higher things, so they are essentially going to disappear when you make the approximation. So this is the equivalent formula of what you've seen already for the operator product expansion of what happens for t and just some primary field phi. And you can also do the same thing for t bar, and you get something similar. You essentially just get bars over everything. But I don't want to keep you any longer, so we're just going to review that next lecture.